Okay, I'd like to get started because we don't have too much time, folks. Okay. Because the bus, I guess, from the motel is going to be here at 4:30, so we have to be sure to be done by then. Okay, so I'm going to just do survival risk group and then something about sample size. So here's the approach. There have been several publications about how to develop survival models using gene expression data. I don't think there actually has been too much published about how you validate it. But here's how we do it actually within BRB Array Tools. And I published a paper with some experimentalists several years ago in PNAS on prostate cancer. And we used not exactly this kind of, we didn't use supervised principal components the way we're doing it here, but we use a very similar approach to validation. So the way we do it is we evaluate, for developing a classifier, we evaluate individual genes by fitting single variable proportional hazards regression models to the log ratio or log signal for one gene at a time, okay? So rather than using t-tests to select genes, we're using one single variable proportional hazards models, okay? Just getting a p-value in that sort of way. And that's pretty straightforward. It's just one gene at a time. And we select genes based on some kind of a p-value threshold, an alpha threshold, for single gene proportional hazard regressions. And then we're using this supervised principal component sort of approach, where we compute the first k principal components of those selected genes. So we've got genes which seem to be informative for survival, and we're going to reduce them. There may be a bunch of them. We're going to reduce them to a small number of predictors, k predictors. We specify k maybe as 3 or whatever. And we compute the linear combinations of those selected genes that correspond to the first k principal components. And then we fit a proportional hazard. Now, of course, what I'm going to do is embed all of this in leave one out training sets or leave 10% out training sets. But I'm just trying to describe here what I'm going to embed. So we fit the proportional hazard regression model with the K principal components as predictors and let B1 through BK be these estimated progression coefficients for those proportional hazard regression, for that proportional hazard regression model. And to predict for a case with some regression, with some expression vector profile X, I compute the K supervised principal components corresponding to that expression profile, call it Y1 through YK, and I multiply each of those principal components by these regression coefficients, and I get what I might call a predictive index. Okay, so this is the idea of supervised principal components used in conjunction with a proportional hazards model, in conjunction with where you're using single variable proportional hazards models to screen the genes. Okay, so basically, this is a kind of, so the basic approach, just to repeat, because we had a couple of people out of the room, we screen the genes using single gene proportional hazard regression models. For those selected genes, we calculate the first K principal components, the linear combinations of those genes, and then we fit a K variable proportional hazard regression model with those K principal components as the variables. And if we wanted to predict something for some patient with an expression profile vector X, what we have to do is identify the components of that X vector that correspond to our informative genes, and then calculate the linear combinations of those informative gene expression levels corresponding to our K principal components, and then just apply those K regression coefficients to calculate a predictive index. Okay, now we're going to embed this in Lee-Wonow cross-validation. So we create a training set by omitting the ith case. We develop a supervised principal component proportional hazard model for the training set. So we apply what I just described to this training set that has the ith case omitted. And then we compute the predictive index for that one that was omitted. Okay? We compute that predictive index for the predictive index was, in other words, for that ith case that was omitted, we identify for the model was developed on that training set. We look at what genes were selected as being informative, what the loadings were on those genes for the K principal components, and so we calculate those K principal components values for this patient that was omitted, and we apply those regression coefficients that were developed in the training set, and we compute the predictive index for that ith case. And now we say, this last step here, we look at that predictive index for that case that was omitted, and we look also at the predictive indices for the cases in that training set, and we say, what is the where that predictive index for the one that was omitted, where does it sit relative to those n minus 1 predictive indices for the cases that we use for actually building that model? So in other words, we have n minus 1 cases that we're actually using in building that model, and we can actually calculate their predictive indices. Now, it's a little bit fishy because that data was used for building the model. They were used for building the model and were calculating their own predictive indices. But we're not going to start calculating anything about whether they're correct or not. We're just going to say, for this one that was omitted, where does it sit as a percentile among those training cases? For example, we might say, is it above the median predictive index or below the median? We might just sort of dichotomize it, say, is it above the median or is it below the median of the predictive indices of those cases in that training set? And if we did that, so now what would we know? We would know for that case that was admitted, we're predicting that it's, say, high risk if its predictive index is above the median, and it's low risk if its predictive index is below the median. So now we have a predicted risk group for that case that was omitted, and its prediction was based on a model that was developed without the one that was omitted. And we do that n times, leaving out each case one at a time. And so now for all of the cases that were omitted, we have some of them predicted to be low risk and some of them predicted to be high risk. So then we say we plot Kaplan-Meier curves, survival curves, for the cases with cross-validated predictive indices above 50%, the 50%, and we calculate a Kaplan-Meier curve for the other cases, for the cases predicted to be low risk. Now, we don't have to use the 50% thing, but I'm using that just to be a little bit concrete here. Actually, the current version of BRBRA tools does use 50%. And so we have a high-risk group predicted and a predicted low-risk group. And we calculate a Kaplan-Meier curve. Now, we also are going to calculate a log rank statistic comparing those Kaplan-Meier curves. That log ranks, we can't do a log rank test. The log rank test is not valid because those predicted, we've used this because there's no independence in these predicted risk groups. Because the predicted risk group for one patient is not really independent from the predicted risk group of another patient because these training sets have so much overlap. So it's not valid. That log rank statistic, its null distribution is not a chi-square. But we can use that statistic as a measure of how different these Kaplan-Meier curves look. And in fact, the Kaplan-Meier curves themselves, you know, tell us a lot. These are cross-validated Kaplan-Meier curves, and they give us, they tell us how well we can predict risk group. You know, we don't. When you think of survival data, the hard part about thinking about it is we don't really want to try to predict survival for individual patients. No systems do that. You think about existing staging systems, stage 1, stage 2, stage 3, they don't give you predictions of survivals for individual patients because we know in a lot of cases that's too hard it's not too hard for patients who are cured, but for patients who are not cured to actually predict what their survival will be, probably not going to do very well. But we do want to predict what we really want from staging systems or new kinds of staging systems is to be able to predict who's good risk and who's bad risk and who's in between. Maybe we want something more refined than upper 50% and lower 50%, and we can refine that easy enough with the same idea. But so the key idea here is we're predicting risk group rather than survival. And by looking at these cross-validated Kaplan-Meier curves, it gives us a pretty good view as to how well we can predict risk group. Now, if we do want to say, well, is this better than by chance, then we can calculate this log rank statistic, and then we can redo the whole thing with permuting the survival data, randomly permuting the correspondence between the survival data and the expression profiles. We don't have class labels to permute, because there's no classes here. But by permuting which survival time and censoring indicator goes with which expression profile, randomly permuting those, and redoing this whole process, for each random permutation, we go through this whole procedure, and we get a new pair of Kaplan-Meier curves and a new log rank statistic. And
How about censoring? How about censoring?
We keep the censoring time with the survival time. Yeah. And what we generate is the null distribution of this log rank statistic. And then we look to see, the actual log rank statistic that we really got from our data, where does it sit in the tail of that distribution? And that's the p-value. And so we repeat the entire procedure for a large number of permutations of survival times and censoring indicators to generate the null distribution of the log rank statistic. And we evaluate the statistical significance of the association by looking where it is in the tail. And there's other approaches we could use for survival risk group prediction that have been published. We can do the same kind of thing with a combination of clinical variables and expression variables. At the step where we're selecting our genes, we can select genes that are significant at our predetermined level from a proportional over and above the clinical variables. Basically, we just do a likelihood ratio test of the proportional hazards model with just the clinical variables versus proportional hazards model with the clinical variables, and that particular gene. And we do that for every single gene, and we select the genes that add to the clinical variables. And then for that set of genes, we calculate the K principal components and do the same thing, embed that whole process in the... when we calculate our predictive index, it's from a model containing the clinical variables and those K principal components of those genes that have incremental value over and above the clinical variables. And basically, that gives us, that does not, however, give us a significance test of the combined model versus the model based only on the clinical variables. Still have to think of a clever way to do that. Okay, sample size. I think this is our last topic, really. Kevin Dobbin and I published paper that sort of, we had done several things on sample size, and the thing that sort of combines them is in this biostatistics publication. And we have another, and that was really, really sample size planning for class comparison studies, where you want to find the genes that are differentially expressed, say, between two or more classes. I think we focus mostly on two classes. And you want to have not too many false positives. And I'll sort of summarize what we did there. And then more recently, we've sort of dealt with a more complicated problem, and that is sample size planning for developing predictors, for developing classifiers. And I think both of these things are in the technical reports on that website. And what we did with for class comparison is very simple, but I personally think it's adequate. And so I was looking to add a slide here because I'll explain why as we get through this. So we view it in a very simple way. Goal: identifying genes differentially expressed and comparing two predefined classes of specimens on dual label arrays using reference design or on single label arrays. Okay, so this is, we also did stuff for other non-common reference designs on dual label arrays, but here I'm going to restrict it to dual label arrays using common reference designs or affymetrix arrays. And basically the approach here is really the simple approach of comparing classes separately by gene with some kind of an adjustment for the fact that we're doing multiple, that we have thousands of genes we're going to apply these tests to one at a time. And approximate expression levels as normally distributed. So here we're basically going to assume that the expression levels of individual genes are normally distributed. My own view, I've done over the years lots of sample size calculations for clinical trials, and I can't think of one I've ever done in which the sample size calculation really was as complicated as the analysis, at least for a phase 3 randomized clinical trial. Sample size calculations are always based on models of analysis that are simplified compared to what you're really going to do. What you're really going to do at the end is probably more complicated than what you could accommodate in a sample size calculation. But what you want in a sample size calculation is to not be too far off and possibly to be on the conservative side. You don't want to try to capture every nuance of how you're going to do the analysis. So here the number of samples, n over 2 per class, to give power 1 minus beta for detecting mean difference level delta at significance level alpha. And the only way we're going to adjust for multiple comparisons, multiple testing here, is by selecting alpha to be small. So in other words, if we want one false positive per 1,000 genes, we're going to use an alpha of 0.001. Now, there is a relationship between alpha and the false discovery rate. I was going to add that slide here. It's in some of our publications. It does depend on the proportion of your genes which are true positive, which are actually differentially expressed, by the degree that you're going to be able to detect. And of course, that's a proportion that you don't know. But you can. We've looked at sort of sensitivity kinds of things and found that if you use alphas of 0.001, then for most realistic kinds of problems, where the proportion of genes that are actually differentially expressed are quite small, it gives you reasonable false discovery rates. And so basically what you do, this is just what you get here, is just basically a very standard sample size formula for two sample normals. And it tells you that in this case, N is the, remember we have N over 2 per each class, so N is the total number. And the Z alpha over 2 is just a normal percent, standard normal percentile from the standard normal distribution at the alpha over 2 tail area. And Z beta is the percentile corresponding to beta, where 1 minus beta is the power you want. And it, of course, depends on delta over sigma. You know, you could take that sigma squared there and put it in the denominator, and then you'd have a denominator of delta over sigma, the quantity squared. And delta, this is written as if it were for a single gene problem. And delta is the difference, say if we're talking about affymetrix arrays, delta is the difference in log signal between the mean of class 1 and the mean of class 2. And sigma is the standard deviation of the log signal within each of the classes, assumed to be the same. And so one thing that we know is not true is, well, sigma is not going to be the same for every gene. And so when we actually apply this kind of formula, we do something like estimate from past data sigmas as a function of genes, and then pick something like the 75th percentile of sigma for use with planning like this. And then the other thing we do is, like I say, is pick an alpha small, like 0.001 or smaller. And if we wind up with very small sample sizes, then we should be using, instead of the percentiles of the normal distribution, we should be using percentiles of the T distribution, because we're actually going to estimate sigma squared from the data in a lot of these cases. But actually, we may be actually doing things in which we borrow information about variances among genes. So in point of fact, we may really have a large number of degrees of freedom for estimating our variance when we really get around to our data. If you make the Z's percentiles of the T distribution, then you have to solve this in an iterative manner, because it depends on the number of degrees of freedom, which depends on N. And actually, so if you use an alpha of 0.001, and if you use a beta of 0.05, corresponding to 95% power, and if you use a delta of 1, delta is sort of, in other words, if we use the logarithm to the base 2 as a measure of the, log signal, then when we calculate our standard deviation, we have to express that as log 2, standard within class standard deviation of the log 2 signal, or the log 2 log ratio. And if you use typically use log to the base 2, so a delta is 1, and we've just sort of looked at various data sets for what within class standard deviations are, and it does depend widely on genes. And I think what we've listed here are sort of 75th percentiles, and a typical 75th percentile for data sets that we've seen are a standard deviation of a half. So which is not too bad. Of course, it's smaller when you deal with model systems like transgenic mice or cell lines. And they lead to actually very small sample size, like, well, I don't know, small or large depending upon what your context is. 13 samples per class is pretty small when you think of clinical studies. On the other hand, for an experimenter who's having to do regrow cell lines and things like that, may not be used to doing large numbers of real biological replications. But the numbers are somewhat smaller than what you might have expected. Of course, if you want to start detecting genes where the true difference between classes is less than twofold, which you very well may want to, your sample size increases rapidly as delta decreases. So if delta is the log of 1.5-fold instead of twofold, log to the base 2, the sample size formula on the previous page will give you a much larger sample size.
Is it for other metrics?
Pardon?
Is it for other metrics?
It's actually
the
0.5. It really wasn't all that much different when we looked at it. I think this is, I think it was affymetrix. I think with a, dual label array, I think the signal was 0.75, so it was somewhat larger. But, you know, it's better to get the sigma from your own, you know, in other words, from your own data. And the formulas that we have in the papers are more complicated than this, in the sense that we break it down into things like, what if you're going to have technical replicates of each biological replicate, or what if you're going to have pooling of specimens, and, you know, we've developed these sample size formulas to be able to address those sorts of things. And I don't think I'll take too much time to go through this, but M is the number of technical replicates per sample, and K is the number of samples per pool. In general, show here, if you pool, we generally feel that pooling samples is a bad idea, and some of the publications that have addressed it have not addressed it properly. But the idea of pooling samples, some cases, like if you're doing expression profiles of Drosophila, you have to pool samples to get enough RNA to do an array. But otherwise, people think of pooling samples to reduce the number of arrays they needed, but it doesn't necessarily. It may do something somewhat reduce the number of arrays you needed, but it increases actually the number of biological replicates you need. And so, if you really analyze it properly, pooling samples and then just doing technical replicates of the of that single pool leads to a very restricted form of inference. And similarly with technical replicates can reduce your number of samples required, but unfortunately the number of arrays required goes up sort of faster than the number of biological samples goes down. So that's not such a great idea either. And there's a similar formula for planning survival studies, where it's the same kind of idea, where it's sort of a one gene at a time sort of thing, based on proportional hazard regression, I believe. I think it may be assuming that, so it's been a while since I derived this, that expression so sigma is the standard deviation of the log 2 ratios for each gene, and delta is the hazard ratio corresponding to a twofold change in gene expression. And again, we have an alpha and a beta. Okay, so I won't, these are the number of events required to for those kind of studies. And of course, the number of, to get 26 events may take a lot of patience. Those are sort of, not patients, those are events. Now let me talk a little bit about sample size planning for classifier development, which finally did this paper on that. It was something I've been thinking about for a long time, and was not so obvious as to how to do this. And the way we did it is we say, well, if we develop a classifier, we have a training set, we develop a classifier, that classifier will have a certain probability of correct classification. So if we have a training set of size n, it will give rise to a classifier if we have some defined way of developing our classifier. And that classifier will have some probability of correct classification for future samples. Now, the probability of correct classification that we get, even for a fixed n, is sort of a random variable because we might have different training sets. And so for planning it, so what we did, if we had an infinite sample size, what if we had an infinite sample size in our training set? Would we be able to classify our cases perfectly in the future? No, not necessarily. We may have an infinite sample size for building a classifier, but if the classes are actually very intermixed, even with the world's best classifier, you may not be able to classify very accurately. Or what if the classes don't actually differ at all with regard to gene expression variables? What if that's certainly very possible? Then the fact that you have an infinite size training sample doesn't mean you're going to be able to predict perfectly, or even better than a flip of a coin. So this is one big basic difference between class comparison and class prediction. Class comparison, if there's any difference in the mean expression for two groups on a gene, if you have a big enough sample size, your power will become one for identifying that gene as differentially expressed between the two groups. However, that gene might not help you very much in predicting whether a particular case is in group 1 or group 2. Because if, in fact, the difference in mean between those two groups is very small relative to the within-group variance, yeah, you'll be able to identify the gene is differentially expressed with a big enough sample size, but that gene is essentially of no value to you for prediction. And so So somebody had asked me, I guess at a break earlier, whether I use in gene selection, where in addition to just using a p-value for selecting genes, I use some kind of a fold difference. Well, we have built into the BOBOA tool software you can use a fold difference in addition to the p-value, and usually I just use the p-value. But you should bear in mind that these genes that are just minimally differentially expressed, they're not really useful for prediction. So here, PCC of infinity is not 1. And so we can't actually formulate this problem by saying, well, we want the probability of correct classification to be at least 0.95. So what we can say is that we want n to be large enough so that the expected value of PCC of n is within some tolerance, gamma, of its maximum achievable PCC of infinity. And so that's what we have taken as our design objective in planning sample size for classifier development. So a probability model for developing this sample size approach, so there's two classes, log expression or log ratio for each class is multivariate normal, the common covariance matrix. There are an unknown M number of differentially expressed genes, and P minus M of the rest of them are noise genes. The expression of differentially expressed genes are independent of the expression of the noise genes. All differentially expressed genes have the same interclass mean difference, 2 delta. It's, of course, not true, but you'll see how we'll deal with it. For sample size planning, it's not going to matter. And that there's a common variance for differentially expressed genes and for noise genes. You can develop sample size method along the lines the way we've done it with some of these assumptions weakened, but then at the planning stage, you don't really have the data you need to know what parameters to put in those things anyway. So what we've tried to do is keep it simple, and the way we try to make, as we see, we'll get to some simplifying assumptions, but we try to make them all simplified in the direction that they hurt our chance of classification accurately, so that the sample size we get is conservative. And, classifier, we assume that feature selection is just based on univariate t-tests for differential expression at some pre-specified significance level alpha. And here's where we make this very simplified assumption that we think is a conservative assumption. It gives us a conservative sample size. We're going to use a simple linear classifier in which all of the genes that are selected for inclusion in the model have the same weight. They're either going to be plus or minus one weight. So genes are either going to be not selected for our classifier, or they're going to be selected with a plus one or minus one sort of weight. And so that's sort of a dumb classifier. And so in real life, when we actually go to use our classifier, we'll presumably be using smarter classifiers. And so they should actually, if we plan our sample size to be good and adequate for using a dumb classifier with, then it should be okay. And the power for selecting each of the informative genes that are differentially expressed by a mean difference of 2 delta is 1 minus beta of n. So this is not really an assumption. This is just a specification of notation. Of course, the power will depend on this sample size. And I'm not going to go through the derivation at all, but I guess I never put it in slideshow mode. So if you have two classes of equal prevalence, which we show how to deal with it if they're not of equal prevalence, but if you have two classes of equal prevalence, and if lambda 1 denotes the largest eigenvalue of the covariance matrix of the informative genes, then you can show that PCC of infinity is less than or equal to this. So for example, if you have M informative genes and they're independent. M genes are differentially expressed between these two classes by mean amount delta, and sigma is the within class standard deviation. And if they're independent, then that eigenvalue is 1. And so it turns out that the probability of correct classification with an infinite sample size is just this phi, where phi is a CDF for the standard normal distribution of delta over sigma times the square root of m. And so, but that's, of course, if you have an infinite sample size, and that's if the m informative genes are independent. And we can then show that, well, if you have a finite sample size n, then you can get this formula, where it again has the delta over sigma. It again has the square root of m over lambda 1, where lambda 1 is that unknown eigenvalue of the largest eigenvalue of the correlation matrix of the informative genes. I mean, that's the problem with sample size planning, is it involves these things that before you have any data, you have no way of estimating. And then remember again, m is the number of informative genes, p is the total number of genes. You're going to do a gene selection step as part of your classifier development, and you're going to select genes based on two sample t-tests using a cutoff alpha. And beta is a function of n. It's that power for your gene selection step. Well, what we then did was we said, okay, I'm going to skip now just to some of the results. And we say, well, we can use this, we can use these kind of formulas in a very simple situation. Suppose we assume that M is 1. Suppose we assume that there's only one informative gene. Well, if there's only one informative gene, then lambda 1 has to be 1, because that's just the eigenvalue of its correlation matrix, covariance matrix, in which it's the only gene. And so this and that are something we can compute with. And that's actually a pretty conservative case. Normally, you think there's going to be more than one informative gene, except they're going to have some kind of correlation pattern, and we don't really know necessarily what to expect for that. So we don't really know what lambda is going to be. So if we use now I don't see that it written here, but basically this I think is based on an M of 1. And the y-axis is showing the sample size, the total sample size that would be split among these two equally prevalent groups. And the x-axis is the difference in the difference of the log expression, the mean difference in log expression of this informative gene between the two classes. And the two curves are for, do we want to be within 10% of the maximum achievable probability of correct selection? Or do we want to be within just 5%? Or do we want to actually be really close to it, be within 5%? If you want to be within 5%, then you need a bigger sample size. But these sample sizes are not all that big. For example, for a value of the x-axis of 1.5, you know, you're at, 50 to 60-ish samples. I think this is for an M of 1. Let's look at this slide for right now. So here we're putting down the first column is the difference between the mean difference between the two classes for the informative gene, and what that corresponds to. 2 to the first column is what's in the second column, and we're assuming here that the within class standard deviation is 0.75, which is I think what we tend to find for the 75th percentile for log ratios on two color arrays for human tissue tumors. And I don't know, let's skip this. This is a little complicated. Let me, one of the things we've done is we've looked at how the optimal alpha level depends on the sample size and the difference in mean expression between the two classes. And when you have a very small sample size and plots of the estimated probability of correct selection is a function of the alpha plotted for various values of n. So, in other words, if you're too stringent for gene selection, if you're really stringent for gene selection, you can see where these curves start on the left, they're way down low. So if you're too stringent, you miss the important gene or genes. And however, if you're too non-stringent, it hurts you, but the rate at which that curve drops off on the right is much more gradual than the rate at which drops off on the left. So you're better off to be a little bit less stringent. And I think we've calculated here, as a function of the gene effect and the sample size, what the optimal alpha is. And see, for very small sample sizes, you don't want to be too stringent. For much larger sample sizes, you can afford to be more stringent. Again, let's skip this one here. This is a correction if you don't have equally likely classes. I want to skip this for right now. Let's go to this. I should have put this earlier. So here we're showing in the left-hand panel, if you have one informative gene, and the right-hand panel is if you have five informative genes and they're independent. And what we're showing is the probability of correct selection as a function of sample size, total sample size. And the different curves correspond to the different effect sizes. And I think when we tend to think about this problem, we tend to think of an effect size of about 1.5, because we don't want to be too optimistic, and we would like to plan things in a conservative way. And so that, in both cases, is the bottommost curve, the curve with the triangles. It corresponds to a difference in mean expression level for the gene between the log expression level for the two classes of 1.5. And as you can see, as your sample size increases, your probability of correct classification increases up to some plateau value, and in the left-hand side, if you have only one gene, you're getting pretty close by a sample size of 60 split between your two classes. You're getting pretty close, and on the right, where if you really had five independent informative genes, even if the mean, you know, with a mean difference, log difference between the classes of 1.5, you're getting pretty close by having a sample size of 40. So 40 or 60, you know, you're talking about, if it's 60, you're talking about 30 samples per class for two equally distributed classes. If you're talking about 60, 40, you're talking about 20 per class. And then if the classes are not equally represented, you don't get as good a power. I think I'd leave it there, except I wanted to just add one thing about the sample size calculation for classification. When we saw these results, we were somewhat surprised in the sense that the sample size requirements were not larger for classification. But I think there's two things to bear in mind. One, this is sample size for sort of building your classifier. If you're going to have a separate test set, this does not include your separate test set. And the other thing is, I think the reason the sample sizes come out the way they are is the following. If you don't have genes that are differentially expressed to a reasonable extent among the classes, then basically you're going to need an infinite sample size. You know, if your genes are very, they're differentially expressed, but the difference is not very large relative to the within-class standard deviation. Even with an infinite sample, your probability of correct classification is not going to be very high. And so, do you really want to have a huge sample size in order to get within gamma of some lousy probability of correct classification? On the other hand, if you have even one gene, if you have one or more genes that are differentially, where the effect size, the difference between the classes divided by the within-class standard deviation, is large enough as to support a good probability of correct. If you can get a good probability of correct classification with an infinite sample size, that means you really need at least one gene that is pretty well separated between the classes. And to identify a gene that is pretty well separated between the classes does not take a huge sample size. And you don't have to isolate that gene from among the noise genes, because including a reasonable number of noise genes does not actually hurt you all that much for class prediction. And so that's, I think, the intuitive explanation of why these sample sizes don't really come out to be horrendous. There have been, you know, you have to be careful in reading sample size papers. There was recently a paper about sample size in which claimed that you needed thousands of samples and it for classification. And what it was sample size for doing two studies and winding up with the same set of genes. And so you really have to read some of these things in a careful way. I don't think I need to say any more about BRB Array Tools software. It's software that I've developed, and it's publicly available for non-commercial use, and it's available from NIH for a license fee, for a one-time license fee for commercial use. And it's different from R. It's different from Bioconductor, in that Bioconductor is sort of a repository. It's a repository of the good and the ugly. It's got good stuff in it, and it's got bad stuff in it. And it also depends on, it's for people who can use R. And BRB Array Tools, we try to not, it's my personally curated analysis package. That I only put in it the stuff that I feel is good to use. And so it's not a repository, and it doesn't require any knowledge of R. And the other thing is a lot of the stuff we have in here is too computationally intensive for R. We want the stuff to run fast, and so when we do these multivariate permutation tests or all of this permutation distribution of cross-validated misclassification errors, we program that in Fortran, not in R. When the stuff isn't too computationally demanding, you know, we program it in R. We use Bioconductor functions whenever we can, but a lot of the stuff is very computationally intensive, and so we've programmed it in Fortran. That's basically, I think, covers pretty much everything I wanted to say. I did want to give some acknowledgement to Kevin Dobbin, who was my postdoc and now is a colleague. Michael Radmaker was a postdoc of mine and a colleague, and he's now at Ohio State. And Sudhir Varma is a postdoc of mine. And Yingdong Zhao is a colleague who developed our Array Tools archive. And we have a BRB Array Tools development team that does the software development for BRB Array Tools. And we have little bit of time for questions.
Yeah, maybe just a couple minutes. There's a, for anybody going back to the Millennium Hotel, there's a show coming at 4:30. Should be down in sort of an area.
I personally am going to walk because I need the exercise.
Yeah. How far?
It's a half mile or something? I walked it from near here yesterday and back. Maybe a mile.
Thanks a lot for coming and taking time.
Thank you.